Your Rules Committee. It is June 11th, and the time is flying by. We have a number of bills that members are involved in, so we're going to tie and take those. But I wanted to let folks know that House Bill 2651, there is an amendment that is not ready, so we will not hear that bill today, and it will either be heard probably Wednesday of this week. So with that, I would open a public hearing on House Bill 3555. Representative Gelser, why don't you come on forward? Ms. Taylor, why don't you tell us what we have?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3555 creates the Task Force on Prevention of Shaken Baby Syndrome, specifies the membership and duties of the task force. You have the -A4 amendment from Representative Gelser that increases the task force membership to 8 members and requires OHSU to staff the task force rather than DHS. And I'd like to point out that this bill does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Good afternoon and welcome.
Thank you, Chair Brown. For the record, my name is Sarah Gelser, and I'm the state representative from Corvallis and Philomath. That's House District 16. I also represent 2 individuals who live in Linn County. House Bill 3555 was introduced at the request of the Oregon Pediatric Society and the Oregon Medical Association. And the idea for this bill came during the discussions about another bill that you all helped pass, which was called Carly's Law, and that was a child abuse investigation bill. The physicians at the child abuse assessment centers were very concerned that we do something this session that would help to prevent child abuse, to supplement what we were doing to help those children that had already been victimized and injured. And they pointed to shaken baby syndrome legislation that has been passed in about 16 states across the United States, which involves requiring hospitals to provide some basic information on shaken baby syndrome through a video-based program before new parents leave the hospital. In the states that have implemented this program, they've seen a decrease of as much as 50% in their rate of shaken babies. And the reason that this is true is that many parents do not understand what it means to shake a baby. A lot of people think shaking a baby, it's taking that baby and just doing a really vigorous shake. But what we had testimony about in the House Rules Committee from a neurosurgeon from Oregon Health Sciences University, Dr. Monica Webby, who was not able to be here today, was that it takes something much less in order to cause severe damage and even death to a baby. Even picking up a baby in the night that's been crying for several hours and just doing this, please just stop, is enough to inflict serious brain damage in that child and potential injury. But what the parents receive from that is the baby stops crying, so they think maybe that's what the baby needed, and they do it again. We had the opportunity to see MRI scans that showed the effects of shaking on the brain, how the brain just starts to liquefy over time. And Dr. Webby talked about how difficult it was when these cases happened, and she knows that she's going to have to go to court and testify against parents who never intended to cause injury to their children. And therefore, this is why the medical community strongly supports doing this type of legislation. As we move forward, the Hospital Association was very interested in this and very helpful, and they asked for the opportunity to bring everyone together in a task force, and rather than mandating that this session, to give the opportunity to have all the partners come together to try to get this up and running statewide on a voluntary basis, to report back in the interim so that we can reassess in 2009 whether or not this is something that we need to mandate to do statewide. The Hospital Association was so supportive of this bill that they have submitted a letter indicating that they will contribute staff and materials and time in order to staff the task force. The amendment before you today corrects a couple of problems and makes one substantive change. The first is that when we wrote the task force language, we inadvertently left out a representative from the Department of Human Services. They should absolutely be there, someone from their public health department. That increases the number of members of the task force from 7 to 8. It clarifies that the parameters for this program are supposed to be about a video-based program, that is the research-based program. And this bill, this amendment, also moves responsibility for the task force from the Department of Human Services to Oregon Health Sciences University. And Brian Boringer is here today and is not signed up to testify, but is happy to confirm OHSU's interest and support for moving this there, and this will help us avoid needing to allocate any general funds in order to put this together. Between OHSU support and the support of the Oregon Hospital and Health Association, there should not be any requirement to allocate any funds for this bill, and perhaps you would consider rescinding the subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Or not. But when it gets to Ways and Means, it would perhaps require no general fund dollars. And with that, I am happy to answer any questions. I do hope that you'll move this bill forward, whether that is to Ways and Means or to the Senate floor. This is a positive thing that we can do in an inexpensive way that is a research-based, proven way to reduce the rate of some very injured and other babies who lose their lives.
Okay. Colleagues, we have before us the Dash 4 amendments that Representative Gelser explained. We have a letter from Dr. Lace on House Bill 3555 and a nod from Brian Berenger at OHSU. Any questions for Representative Gelser, Senator Montes-Anderson?
Yes. Why did you limit it just to hospitals? I keep thinking when I had my kids, I was in such a euphoric stage that I wouldn't pay any attention that was to anything that was bad, you know, and in there only for a short period of time. To me, I think it should be far more inclusive of birthing centers, I mean of Lamaze classes and well baby clinics and the WIC program and Healthy Start and the Department of Corrections. Anyway, there's managed care, you know, plans. They're just, to me, I think it's very limiting to be focusing on hospitals when I was working, I didn't work OB very long because it just wasn't my fit. But we are cramming so much stuff into such a short amount of time to these new moms. So would you entertain expanding this a little bit more than just to focusing it on hospitals?
Chair Brown, Senator Montes-Anderson, thank you for that question. The bill doesn't limit. Certainly this task force can have broader discussions about how to prevent shaken baby syndrome. There are other states that require this training to be given to teenagers that might be babysitting, to child care providers, and some of the other places that you mentioned. This bill was a priority bill for me that I introduced late in the session at the request of the OMA and the Oregon Pediatric Society, and really was based on that research-based program. And that was one of the questions that I had. I've had four babies. I've brought them home. I know how overwhelming that time period is. But they did do research to follow up later with families participating in the program and found that they had a very high rate of recall, and that this was the best place on this particular issue to be providing this information to families. They're not just talking about the appropriate ways to calm a crying baby. They're helping these families understand that frustration and angst that you feel, you know what that's like. It kind of rushes through your body after you've been hearing a newborn cry for many hours. It helps them understand that crying is normal and to understand what some of those other calming techniques are. So this bill is based on that research-based program that has reduced shaken baby by 50% and is not intended to be limiting of further discussions this task force might have. And certainly they may come back to us with broader recommendations in the interim.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you very much. We appreciate you joining us. And you know that President Courtney signs my paycheck, don't you?
Yes.
Okay. Just checking. Next up, I have Jane Ellen Wydans. Oh, there you are. Welcome.
Thank you.
Anybody else wishing to testify on this very important bill?
Senator, Chair Brown and members of the committee, my name is Jane Ellen Wydans with the Hospital Association, and when Representative Gelser said someone promised to staff it, it's me that will be staffing this work group in the interim. We believe that this is a critical issue. Hospitals want to play a critical role and a frontline role in developing a statewide plan on shaken baby prevention. Thank you for Senator Montes-Anderson for mentioning the other issues that we think that this work group or this task force needs to look at. 70% of the perpetrators of abuse, of shaken baby abuse, are actually men, so we think we need to be creative in figuring out ways to reach out to men. Another 20% are actually substitute caregivers, such as babysitters, so we want to look at ways of reaching out to the people who train babysitters and family members of people who have children providing those types of services, and professional babysitters and child care centers, so that we can really have a frontline progressive model in Oregon of how we prevent shaken baby syndrome. So we're at the table. We're happy to be leading this discussion and helping to bring back to you a full plan that will actually look at not just hospitals, but everything that Oregon could be doing to prevent this horrible tragedy from happening. And I want to thank Representative Gelser for all her work on this issue. I think it has a good time to bring this forward at this point. So thank you.
Thank you. Questions? I think you're off the hook. Thank you. All right. Anybody else wishing to testify on House Bill 3555? The three times the triple nickel, not seeing any volunteers. We're going to close the public hearing, open a work session. Senator Montes Anderson.
I move the dash four amendments to House Bill 3555.
Senator Montes Anderson has moved the dash four amendments to House Bill 3555. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing and seeing none, so ordered.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3555 as amended to Ways and Means.
With the due pass recommendation.
With the due pass recommendation.
Thanks. Any discussion? Krista, would you please call the roll?
Senator Botkin?
Aye.
Senator Farioli?
Aye.
Senator Cruz?
Aye.
Senator Montes
Anderson? Aye.
Chair Brown?
Chair votes aye. Motion carries. Thank you very much. Good luck. All right. With that, we're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 1056. Ms. Johnson, why don't you come on forward? I think we left this off that you had some that some folks in the manufactured housing community had some concerns. You went into the hallway, and I think you've reached a resolution. Is that correct?
Yes, we have, Chair Brown and members of the committee. We met with Legislative Council. We have amended, if you look at Section 2, Subsection 4, takes care of the no-cause eviction, which was raised that the bill as written previously could potentially limit the park owners from the no-cause eviction. So we have amended the bill and clarified that, and everyone's taking a look at the amendments, and we're all in agreement.
Great.
And support the dash twos and hope it'll go out today.
All right. Anybody else wishing to testify? I know that Mark Long is in the room if anybody has any questions or he's around somewhere. Oh, there he is. Okay. The chair would move the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 1056. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing and seeing none, so ordered. The chair would move the bill as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Okay. All right. All right. Any objection? Hearing seeing none. So ordered. Senator Verger will let her carry the bill.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Let's go back up to the top of the agenda. House Bill 3321, folks. You just scream at me if I'm moving too fast.
No.
And then I'll wear exactly what you're wearing tomorrow as well. All right. Close the work session on Senate Bill 1056.
It's just mandatory when
you guys blew it. You totally and completely blew
pretty
it.
Pretty close.
Sarah Rockian, you are close, but you don't have the right touches.
I did not get the memo.
About that, actually.
Not get the memo, or you got it from the wrong side of the bed, Senator Cruz. All right, open a work session on House Bill 3321. Ms. Taylor, why don't you tell us what we have?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3321 modifies provisions relating to coverage of the membership of association health plans. You have the dash A6 amendment in your packet, which defines those association health plans.
Who wants to start?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jessica Adamson with AGC. This bill, the dash A6 amendment, simply clarifies that this legislation applies to association health plans, multiple employer welfare arrangements, also known as MEWAs, and discretionary groups. This was the subject of the bulletin that initiated the need for House Bill 3321 in the first place. This simply is a technical amendment to bring all of those in. This is a consensus amendment and makes this bill an even better bill than it was in the first place.
Yay. Ms. Tressel, you want to add anything? Okay. Questions from the committee? I don't know, whatever you guys had for lunch, I think it was a good thing. All right.
That's true,
Senator Cruz. All right, we're in work session. Senator Farioli, they were your amendments, as I recall.
Yes, Madam Chair. I would move the amendments to House Bill 3321.
Which one?
A6.
Yes. Senator Farioli has moved the dash A6 amendments to House Bill 3321. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing, seeing none. So ordered, Senator Farioli.
Madam Chair, I would move House Bill 3321A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Farioli has moved House Bill 3321 as amended with the dash A6 amendments to that Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection? Hearing seeing none. So ordered, Sarah Ferriello, you want to carry the bill?
I'm sure that'll be the second bill of the session that I...
Oh, well, we're going to just load you up from now on.
No, thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay.
He's way behind.
He's way behind?
I'm carrying bills.
You carry a lot of bills. Sarah Montes-Anderson carries a lot of bills.
Yes.
All right, let's go 2637. All right. All right, we're going to open a work session on House Bill 2637.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, as you remember, House Bill 2637 requires schools to adopt policies prohibiting and procedures for reporting and investigating acts of cyberbullying. You heard this late last week?
Yes. And there are no amendments that the proponents want.
No.
I guess that's correct.
Chair, I prefer to move the bill as we received it.
I think that's a good motion. Senator Cruz would move House Bill 2637 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Might you call the... Or you want some discussion?
Actually,
go ahead.
Madam Chair, I think that we were pretty vocal about the bill last time around. I don't think we need to expand the record.
Okay. All right. Why don't you call the roll, Krista, please?
Senator Ferriello?
No.
Senator Cruz?
Aye.
Senator
Montes-Anderson? Aye.
Senator Bachman?
Aye.
Chair votes aye. Motion carries.
Madam Chair?
Senator Ferriello.
Vote explanation?
Oh, sure.
I think the purpose of the bill is a good purpose. I think it has some constitutional questions about who does what and how you limit the issues of speech.
Okay.
Other than that, it's a great bill.
Minor details, the Constitution.
Minor details. Thank you.
Okay. Do you
want to
share it or should I give it to Senator Devlin?
Let's give it to Senator Devlin.
Okay. We're going to give that to Senator Devlin because it's building on his earlier work. All right.
That's good. I'm very Devlin.
Okay.
So
you can call the members. Okay. All right. Let's do 3314. Is Bill Taylor coming down? I think we're going to work session.
In the back.
To 3314, actually public hearing and work session. There were some amendments needed on this bill, and we need to call members, so we might need to be at ease for a minute.
He's actually here.
Oh.
He's in the back. He's right there.
Bill Taylor? Oh, I didn't see. Oh, my gosh, I did not see you. Come on up.
Jack Evans and Scott Perfect. Can come up too, please.
Mr. Taylor, what do you and your guests have?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, you have the B-11 amendments in front of you. This bill increases the penalty for careless driving when the driver causes physical injury or death to a vulnerable user of a public way, defines vulnerable user of a public way as a pedestrian, person riding an animal, a highway worker, and person operating any of the following on a public way crosswalk,
a
shoulder of a highway. Farm vehicle without an enclosed shell, B, a skateboard, C, roller skates, D, inline skates, E, scooter, or F, a bicycle. What happened, Madam Chair, members of the committee, we adopted a set of amendments in Senate Judiciary Committee, which are shown to you in the B. Engross version of the bill. And on page 3, there is an ambiguity there that could cause some problems. Basically, it says the department shall take action to Section 1 of the section upon receipt of a record of conviction for careless driving. Department of Transportation was concerned that that would mean that every time they received a conviction for careless driving, regardless of whether it involved a vulnerable user or a public way, they would have to suspend the license. That was not the intent of the committee. Arguably, that's not what it does, but it's very ambiguous. And what you have in the B-11 amendments, Madam Chair, members of the committee, is basically it says that over on page 5, when a court orders suspension of driving privileges under ORS, 811-135, the department shall immediately suspend all driving privileges of the person for 1 year. That clarifies the ambiguity, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Bricker, you want to add anything?
Just really brief, Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Scott Bricker with the Bicycle Transportation Alliance, Vermont Pedestrian Coalition. Thanks for hearing this bill. The only clarification is that this actually is serious physical injury or death. Serious physical injury is a raised bar. It's a trauma level injury. So this is not necessarily just broken arm. This is a serious injury. If there are any questions, I can go into where this bill came from, of course.
Mr. Bricker, I just want to clarify that riding an animal could be a horse, for example.
That would be, Madam Chair, that would be the example, the main example we were thinking of.
Okay. Questions from the committee?
Madam Chair, I would like to hear a little more about the serious injury issue.
Sure.
Okay. Well,
Madam Chairman of the committee, Senator Farioli, ORS 161015, subsection 8, defines serious physical injury means physical injury which creates a substantial risk of death or which causes serious and protracted impairment of health or protracted loss of impairment of the function of a bodily organ. It's well defined in Oregon statutory law and the substantial case law that further elaborates on the term.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I think seriously, it's serious injury. So, Senator Cruz.
Madam Chair, Bill, so one could assume, let's say you had multiple breaks in your leg and so you were going to be months in a cast, that would probably qualify because you would not be able to work, you would not be able to do a whole lot of things. Mm-hmm. So is duration part of that consideration in what would be termed as serious? Let's say you're going to be in a cast for 6 months or something like that and had to miss work. Would that qualify?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senator Cruz, I think so.
Okay.
At least by the definition, but right. To be sure, I'd want to go take a look at the case law. Multiple breaks, yes.
Pardon me? That didn't actually enter my mind, so. But.
Other questions?
Yes.
Senator Bakken.
With respect to the term bicycle, more and more you see vehicles that are powered by a human being that have three wheels instead of two, such as the kind that ride low to the ground. They got two in the back, one in the front. They're even harder to see by a car. And in my support of the bill, I guess my intent behind it is that bicycle isn't limited to just a two-wheeled vehicle, but a vehicle that's powered by a human on the side of the road.
Mr. Bricker, do you want to respond to that one?
Yes, briefly, Madam Chair, Senator Bakken. It is true that right now the definition of bicycle is actually, it's a pretty strict definition. It has a whole bunch of equipment requirements and whatnot, and there are certain vehicles that would act and operate like bicycles that are not qualified under bicycles under the current law, and that is something for us to consider taking on. In fact, I think there may have been a bill that didn't go anywhere that was looking at four-wheeled bicycles and incorporating them into bicycles. So, Senator Bakken, I think that is an issue, and as it goes, it would actually take some serious restructuring, I think, or it could take some restructuring of the equipment law related to a bicycle to include all things that would operate.
But this term is limited to a two-wheeled vehicle powered by a person.
Madam Chairman, as the committee, Senator Bakken, I'd have to take a look at the definition. I did look at it a while ago, and I did not think it was limited to two, even though bi means two. As opposed to unicycle, which means one, I didn't think it was limited.
I'm not suggesting amendments. I'm just
laying out a record that now is thoroughly and completely confused.
Yeah, I didn't help at all. I thought that would move us in the right direction.
Good job.
But it is clear a number, at least, of the vehicles that are low to the ground in the Portland metropolitan area are is it recumbent? Is that the word, recumbent bicycles? And those are literally two, but they're low to the ground.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I believe that that a recumbent on two wheels would classify as a bicycle. A recumbent on three wheels may not classify as a bicycle. There are very few of those in Portland. I think if you were in West Palm Beach, Florida, you might see a lot more of those. Most of the vehicles we see as bicycles would be considered bicycles.
All right.
Madam Chair.
Senator Farioli.
Sensing an opportunity for research.
Okay.
But I do have a question.
Sure, go ahead.
There's a class of vehicle that we're encountering more frequently on the roads, streets and roads, particularly in urban areas. They're literally motorized skateboards.
Mm-hmm.
Those folks are not required to be licensed there's a certain CC limitation. I think it's under 50. And they are not pedestrians, nor are they motorized vehicles, although there's a motor running these things. How would those folks be treated? You know, you've seen the little scooters hurtling through traffic and the skateboards darting into and out of, you know, I think these things live under a particular sense of grace because, you know, they're almost invisible and they move pretty quick. And how would they be covered in this bill?
Do you have a take on this? I can take a shot.
Very good question.
Simply go over to the convention, I'll be called scooters. Madam Chairman, as the committee Senator Ferrioli, in talking about a skateboard, it's in the definition, inline skates, a scooter or a bicycle. I know what you mean by an engine because we just bought a bike Saturday with an electric motor to it, tied up the batteries.
Mm.
But I still think it's a bicycle, and I believe the law treats it as a bicycle.
Okay. Well, you couldn't find a population that could be more particularly defined as a vulnerable user of a public highway. Cause
I know.
A lot of them don't even wear helmets.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Thank you very much. Any thoughts you guys have as we're wrapping up here?
Well, Madam Chair, Members of the Committee, I just want to throw in that the gist of this issue, and in fact there was a death that happened this weekend in Washington mm-hmm. County, is to try and create a fair, high bars, a fair treatment, which is basically a community service program for deaths that are happening on the roadway with careless low behavior to people who are vulnerable, that don't have shells, I mean, that you just can't play bumper cars with. These people wind up dead. So from our standpoint, that's the thrust of this bill. I do think that it's hard because there are a lot of non-motorized vehicles, vulnerable vehicles that are not specifically laid out in law, and you could put something together in your backyard as well. So from that standpoint, there were some challenges in creating a definition. I think we've done as good of a job as we can here, and I hope that satisfies the committee. Thank you.
And Scott, just to clarify on the accident that happened this weekend, I don't remember from reading the paper, but my recollection is that the fellow was, were they riding on a shoulder and making a left-hand turn? Is that what happened?
Yeah, Madam Chair, that is correct. I have a brief article here, but basically there were five bicyclists, so they were riding lawfully. They were merging left. They had signaled. The woman was cited with careless driving, who struck and killed the cyclist, so would have fit under this program. She actually had a suspended license. I mean, there were probably a bunch of other things going on there. But, yes, so that was something that would fit here. But the bicyclists were riding, and they were merging to take a left turn, and this vehicle tried to pass in a no-passing zone.
I'm sure I have no desire to impede the progress of this bill, but I would like to share a fact set that doesn't seem to fit here. A child, I think a 12-year-old boy, was run over in a crosswalk and killed, and it was determined that he was not a pedestrian because he was on a skateboard. Mm. And he was, you know, literally outside the protection of the law for pedestrians because he was on a
skateboard.
Well, he wasn't a pedestrian. He was, mm-hmm. you know, moving fast in traffic, came off the curb, ended up underneath the wheels of a truck. The driver was not cited. And the point is, this definition of who's covered might be an evolving thing for us to look at in the interim between sessions.
Okay, I appreciate that.
I think that's a really good point. Okay, we're going to close. We've got a number of legislators here. I would like to hold this toward the end of the day. We've got a number of legislators here, but we need to move forward on this bill. Thanks, everyone. Close the work session. Representative Flores, Representative Thatcher, why don't the two of you come forward on House Bill 2603, and then I think Representative Flores, you also have 3113. Is that okay? And I know that Dr. Morrow is in the room as well, so we'll ping him up when you guys are done with this bill. Oh, these are visual aids.
Permission to use a bit visual aid, Madam Chair.
Welcome. Go ahead. 2603.
Oh, okay. I'm just for the record, I'm Kim Thatcher, representative from Kaiser. I represent Newburgh, St. Paul, and Kaiser in House District 25. And it's my honor to bring this bill to you.
indulge you with a little bit of a demonstration project. This bill is all about the kinds of materials that we legislators post, the information that we post on our websites, and more specifically, what kind of information we can link to. We'll pick on Representative Flores for just a minute. And we'll be clicking through to what are called hyperlinks. And I will just assume that you don't know anything about hyperlinks, but you probably do. I'm sure you've clicked on plenty of these. But what a hyperlink is an electronic link providing direct access from one distinctively marked place in a website to another. And a year ago, none of us were allowed to have these on our legislative web pages because there was all sorts of chaos and controversy going on over what we could and couldn't use for links. For example, one representative couldn't link to the Boy Scouts, and I was told that the Smart Reading Program was off limits. And yes, there was some legitimate reasons for these concerns, and some of them dealing with elections law. And some were dealing, of course, with ethics law. In March of last year, all 90 websites for individual legislators were torn down, and legislative council recommended a policy that allowed nothing except government links. Now, at the time, there were 1,600 links posted on these sites not related to the government, and some were related to political sites and probably were a violation of state law, existing state law. We're not asking to go against that. We're just asking that legislators be responsible for what goes on their website. And here's a little quote from one of my that came from a paper when this situation emerged. It says, banning legislators from posting links set a bad precedent of censorship and abridges free speech. I encourage our legislators to post responsibly in a way that shows you're interested in helping Oregonians make this a better world. I'll turn this over to another co-sponsor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, I'm Linda Flores, State Representative for House District 51. And after all the excitement died down last year and all the discussions that were involved, what basically we came up with and we're hopeful to achieve is a bill that holds the legislative members accountable and make the buck stop with each elected member and the construction use of their various websites, and not hold our staff liable for any type of material that should not be there. And just to reaffirm, ethics laws and election laws do already address some of these issues, but as a result of the recommendations from the work group, this was important to come up with. And you see on the website the form that I also hold in my hand, which is an agreement that legislative administration put out so that members could sign and hold us all accountable, indicating that we understand our responsibility. 65 of the members out of the 90 of us did sign up and submit that form. The Public Commission on the Legislature, in its deliberations during the last number of months during the interim, indicated their concerns about better public use and access of the legislative websites, and that public information outreach is very critical. So this is, we see, as a very important element in restoring some of the credibility for the legislative body and the citizens, seeing that we can and do make our technology user-friendly and that our constituents have resources available that we can link to that would be community-oriented and they would not be going to those forbidden places. So we hope that you will agree with the House Rules Committee and the House floor. I do not think that we received one no vote, as it has thus far moved through the process, and encourage your support for this particular House Bill 2603. Questions? We call the hyperlinks bill.
Okay, great. And great video.
Visuals.
Sarah Montes Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Say you have a bill that you've been talking about on your web, and then there's an article written about it in a paper, and you have the link to the article with the newspaper. That's all right.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Monis Anderson. That is all right. What this is trying to prevent is going to partisan sites, whether it's Republican Party site, Democrat Party site, and those types of things that are definitely have a partisan nature, but to use it as a reference tool to articles that pertain to legislation and so on is within the purview.
Thank you.
Sarah Cruz.
Yeah. How far afield could I go? I mean, for example, Jacqueline Zimmer has been working on a website that people can link to for senior services, which is really dramatic, and that's going to link to other websites for other sorts of services. I mean, that sort of linkage would be okay with this or not? I mean, so if somebody went to my website and I say, just you can link into here where you're already at and get to that site, is that an acceptable use?
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, I'm sorry if I said representative.
doesn't matter.
It is. What you're trying to avoid is going into your personal campaign sites, as long as it
is.
And those.
So if there's a public purpose.
And to Buffy's adult store, you don't want to do that.
Well,
but I don't know how to get there. But I don't. Okay, but
under the current law, you couldn't. But
with this, I would be able to. If somebody came to my web page, I would be able to link them on that page to these other sorts of sites for
information.
Paid.
Not Buffy's.
I've got a question. If Senator Cruz needs help, that's in bailing you out completely.
Okay.
Do you have a question?
I do have a question.
Go ahead.
Where it says that the member is liable, are you contemplating that means the member is personally liable or that they're liable in their official capacity as a state employee?
Chair Brown, Senator Avakian, that's what is contemplated, is that as the legislator is responsible as a legislator and responsible for that initial link to whatever site, and currently, if you haven't signed one of those little forms, you can't do that.
So we're contemplating that they would be covered by the Oregon Tort Claims Act, or any other, or if a claim was made, that maybe the Attorney General's office would be involved in representation, or are the members completely liable on their own as individuals?
Chair Brown, Senator Avakian, I just want to say for the record that no complaints have been made even up till now. Right. And so it's not common. It's just that suddenly the legislative committee, is that the name of it? Leg admin, decided that suddenly they didn't want us posting anything other than government websites, and that just really kind of slowed the process down as far as us as individual legislators communicating with our constituents. And this would allow us to be able to communicate effectively with our constituents. And what legislative administration was worried about is if they were posting to, let's say, the smart reading site, and it, for some reason, you know, they were just worried about being liable themselves. If there should be anything controversial that they're linking to.
Thank you. Senator Avakian, I'm not sure I can answer your question, but my sense is that the context in which this is used is that the member is personally responsible for complying with Oregon ethics laws and Oregon campaign laws and also with the House or the Senate rules. In terms of the liability questions that you raise, I think that's a little, you lost me there on that one. So, it may be legitimate. I don't know. I'm just trying to think of a scenario that you would have a hyperlink to a smart page and get sued for that.
Here's an example.
Okay.
I put a link up to the Boy Scouts, and the Boy Scouts has pictures of kids doing whatever on camping trips, and some parent doesn't want the picture of their kid out on a state website that's accessible to everybody in the state like this, and so they sue. And I'm not saying that'd be a valid lawsuit, but so they sue. Are they suing the legislator as an individual, so then the legislator has to defend themselves, or are they covered by all the liability that the state gives to its employees? Because that doesn't say here. It simply says that the member is liable. Or if something goes to a link that is defamatory in some way.
Senator Vakian, just for chuckles, I do see someone from the ACLU here who I'm not going to bring up, but I just think that the plausibility of such a lawsuit connected to the legislator are unlikely. But again, anyone can sue anyone. And
Madam Chair, I think what this is trying to do is say that staff people are not.
Yeah. Right.
It's to give them cover and say if there is liability, however remote it would be on the legislator, not the staff people who are posting under the direction of the legislature.
Chair Brown, Senator Cruz, that's correct. And it is really primarily focused on not necessarily the inclusion of pictures of kids and the use of that type of thing. Andrew, stay back there. but it is trying primarily to focus on where the links take you.
Right.
And ethics rules, campaign rules already do guide us on the complaint-driven process, as this would.
And Senator Vakian, assuming the other piece you're asking, if such a lawsuit were to take place, is whether it is holding the legislator as an individual or in their capacity as a state senator. That's really what you're asking, right?
Yes.
Okay. All right. I think it's in their capacity as a state senator, but we'll take a look at it. All right. Thank you very much. We appreciate your presentation. Anybody else now wishing to testify on House Bill 2603, except all the lawyers in the room?
Yeah.
So, all right.
Thank you. Committee.
Thank you. We'll take a look at this. We'll bring it back on Wednesday. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2603. Let's open a public hearing on House Bill 3113. Marjorie, Representative Flores, I don't know if you want to come forward. Sorry, I shouldn't even let you go.
Madam Chairman of the Committee, House Bill 3113 requires DHS and law enforcement agencies to jointly determine respective roles in conducting investigation of child abuse, either if either one has received a report of child abuse at a child care facility. You have the -B7 amendments, which we understand resolve conflicts with Senate Bill 379. And again, this is purely a conflict amendment.
Take it away.
Chair Brown, members of the committee, Representative Ron Mauer, House District 3, and we wish they resolve the conflicts, but unfortunately we don't believe that they do. Page 3, the last paragraph of page 3 of the B7 amendments actually create new language that does not resolve a conflict but creates a new Pandora's box that we don't want to go. Senate Bill 379 deals with a department's disclosure of information or contact back to someone that makes an allegation. And B7 says that the department and law enforcement will make that disclosure, which would be inappropriate. It should only be the department. And so we need to return to LC and talk to them and review the language that talks about law enforcement.
Okay.
So we would like to have this brought back
quickly.
Wednesday would be appropriate.
Could you tell us any comments, questions by the committee in terms of the substance of the bill? Mm-hmm. All right. I think you're in good shape. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Quickly.
Tell them we want to go home.
Soon.
All right, anybody else wishing to testify on House Bill 3113? We'll bring this back on Wednesday for a fix-up to unconflict the conflict amendments which were drafted to resolve the conflicts. All right, let's go to 2674, open a public hearing. Mr. Zoltan, anybody else? Ms. Taylor, why don't you tell us what the bill is?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2674 requires employers to pay amounts deducted from the employee wages in accordance with law or some sort of agreement requiring or authorizing those deductions, and again, make that payment within 7 days.
Mr. Zoltan.
Chair Brown, members of the committee, for the record, Mark Zoltan, Legislative Affairs Director for the Bureau of Labor and Industries, here today to testify in support of House Bill 2674. This bill would require employers to properly dispense payroll deductions in a timely manner per their agreements with their employees authorizing such deductions. The failure of the employer to do so would be considered an unlawful payroll deduction. The need for this legislation came to our attention when employees complained that their employers were not forwarding on their payroll deductions, such as child support payments, charitable deductions, or even union dues. The Bureau had been contacted in the past by employees whose child support payments were not properly forwarded, and as a result, we drafted legislation, Senate Bill 145, for consideration during the last legislative session. That bill did not make it to the finish line. This session, we worked closely with Representative Brad Witt, who also passed on some constituent complaints regarding this issue, and we agreed on the House side to set 7 business days as the reasonable time frame during which an employer must deduct and then pay the proper amount authorized to a third party, unless there's a voluntary agreement between the employer and the employee that sets out a different time frame. There were 2 other amendments on the House side, including one sponsored by Representative Vicki Berger, and the Bureau supported both of those amendments. In conclusion, this is a straightforward attempt to make sure that when an employee authorizes any type of payroll deduction, deduction is made properly and dispensed with within a reasonable time period. We appreciate your consideration and urge your support of this bill. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions? You're off the hook?
Thank you.
No amendments? No new amendments.
Just a quick question, Madam Chair.
Sure. Senator Farioli.
Probably. This may be improbable, but I want to be assured that it is improbable. Is there a situation where a person could have a garnishment or a child support deduction required where the agency that's required to post that is delayed or recalcitrant or doesn't make the proper contact with the employer, and notwithstanding that failure is an agency failure, the employer is still going to be held liable for not making the deduction within 7 days?
Chair Brown, Senator Farioli, I guess that could occur, but in those cases, if the employee was aggrieved, came to the Bureau, filed a wage and hour complaint with us, and we investigated and found that it was the third party on that end that was at fault, in essence, and bogged down the process, then we would not make a finding against the employer. That would, in my opinion, come out during our investigation that it was not the employer's fault, and they would not be held liable for that.
And last question is probably...
Senator Ferry, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Indicates how well I've read this piece of legislation. And this is complaint-driven?
Yes, totally complaint-driven. We do not have an army of folks out in the field looking into this. This would just make it, put it in state statute that this is an unlawful practice that you can file a complaint upon and be found and penalized if you're found guilty.
And Madam Chair, last question.
Sorry,
can anyone other than the employee bring the complaint?
Chair Brown, Senator Farioli, I don't believe in this type of wage and hour complaint that we would accept a complaint except from the party that was aggrieved.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Anybody else? All
right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Anyone else wishing to testify on House Bill 2674? It's your last opportunity. All right. With that, we'll close the public hearing, open a work session. Chair would move 2674B to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Krista, would you call the roll, please?
Senator Cruz? No.
Senator Montez?
Aye.
Senator Vakian?
Aye.
Senator Farioli?
No.
Chair
votes aye. Motion carries. Senator Vakian, would you be willing to carry that on the Senate floor? Great. All right. Close the work session. Let's go. I think we have 2 bills left to deal with. One is House Bill 3314. Open a work session.
437, you mean.
I'm sorry?
Oh,
the bicycle one. Yeah, I'm going to go back and do the work session, and then we'll do the hearing on 3437 for all the audience. In work session on 3314, are folks feeling comfortable? This is the bicycle bill.
Mm-hmm. Never have been.
Never have been? Oh, good. Okay. Sarah Vakian, would you move the dash
B11
amendments? Holy smokes.
So moved.
Senator Vakian has moved the dash B11 amendments discussion. I would only say I anticipate we're going to need to come back and take a look at this in terms of the definition of bicycle, and there may be some other issues next session. So, Senator Farioli.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just looking at the relating clause relating to vehicular contact with a vulnerable user of the public way, I would just suggest, Madam Chair, that there are probably further definitions, but this, I think this is going to be something that grows in the telling of the story.
Probably. So, all right. The motion is to move the dash B11 amendments. Krista, would you please call the roll?
Senator Montanez?
Aye.
Senator Buckin?
Aye.
Senator Perioli?
Aye.
Senator Cruz?
Aye.
Chair votes aye. Motion carries. Senator Bakian moves the bill as amended with the dash B11 amendments to the Senate floor with a DuPage recommendation. Discussion?
Yes, I do move, and yes, for discussion purposes, just because the testimony was somewhat ambiguous about what some of the terms mean, that it seems to me that the intent of the committee is clearly to protect those people that are moving on these byways that are not on in a car, a van, or a truck, that are in some other type of a smaller vehicle, and that if the intent is ever questioned, that a court or somebody else would err towards the protection of those vulnerable individuals.
Thank you, Senator Vaki, and it looks like Mr. Taylor has some definition, too.
Oh.
Now you've done it.
Yes.
ORS 801-150 defines what a bicycle is. Designed to travel with not more than three wheels in contact with the ground, is designed to be operated ground on wheels, as a set or sandal for the use of the rider, is propelled exclusively by human power. But there is another definition that also defines an electric-assisted bicycle as a bicycle.
All right. I think we're in really good shape, given the intent and the clear statement of the law by prior legislatures. Senator Montes Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. These little toys that you can now get that actually have four wheels that are electric, that little kids can go out on the sidewalks and even on the street with, which I would never allow my child to go out on the street with. But hopefully they would be covered, too.
Madam Chair?
Sarah Montes Anderson, I think the clear answer to that is no. Four wheels and electrical powered, I think it's pretty clear that you need some level of human empowerment under the bicycle option. So, Senator Farrielly.
Madam Chair, I'm going to rely on the line 20, page 1, to be the triggering point. Something that causes serious physical injury or death to a vulnerable user. And I think the other definitions are going to follow.
Yep. I think that's well said. All right. So parents, keep your kiddos in their little teeny electric cars off the public. Oh, my gosh. This means that they would be on a highway, on the shoulder on the highway. That would be bad. Then the parents should be somewhere else, and we think that's in juvenile court. All right. The motion on the floor was to move the bill as amended with the dash B11 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Krista, why don't you call the roll, please?
Senator Vaccaro.
Aye.
Senator
Aye.
No.
Aye. Brown votes aye. Motion carries. We're going to give this to Senator Przyjanski.
Yeah.
There you go.
Our bicycle nut. All right. Last but not least, at least for the day, House Bill 3437, at least for the time being. Ms. Taylor, House Bill 3437.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3437 adds the member of order crocodilia to the definition of the exotic animal. We did receive the dash A6 amendment that I'm sure that one of your witnesses will want to discuss, but I'd like to remind you that this is the B in gross bill that you're considering, therefore the A6 won't fit in this bill.
Okay. Ms. Peterson, Mr. Barrows and Mr. Tucker, and then we'll bring up opponents. I assume Randy's out wandering the hallway somewhere. And Mr. Sonnenberg, I had your name down. I have you down as an opposition. I'll bring you up with that. I've got a couple of panels in opposition. So I did want to let you know that we'd gotten your name. So, Mr. Phillips, did you want to testify? Okay. All right. Ms. Peterson.
Madam Chair and committee members, my name is Kelly Peterson, and I'm here. I'm the Oregon Program Director with the Humane Society of the United States, and I'm here today on behalf of our 130,000 members testifying in support of House Bill 3437. And just briefly, I pass out some material. Some of the folks who had testified at the House and the House Rules Committee weren't able to attend today, but their written comments are introduced to the record. Oregon already has a law that requires requires all persons possessing any non-human primates, wild felines, wolves, and other non-native wild canids and bears kept as pets to obtain a license through the Oregon Department of Agriculture. It's an annual license, and the owner has to comply to certain housing requirements. House Bill 3437, as it passed out of the House with a vote of 42-12, just merely phases out the issuance of any new license to keep an exotic animal after the effective date of the bill. And it also adds a family of crocodilia to the list. And so all individuals will still be able to keep their exotic animal that they possess today. However, they won't be able to acquire any new ones after the effective date of the law. There has been some confusion about the USDA license exemption, so I just want to be clear that this retains the current list of exemptions for wildlife rehabilitation centers and for facilities operating under the valid USDA license. And those people include USDA breeders, dealers, research, or exhibitor licenses. They're all exempt from the bill, and they can continue to acquire new animals. They can continue to breed and exhibit their animals. They're not affected at all by the bill. You'll likely hear from people today that do hold a USDA license, but it really is important to know that they're not impacted at all. In addition, we did hear from opposition. It did take about 4 months to work through this bill, and we tried to address some of the concerns that were raised. And to that end, we included a cat hybrid exemption. There were a lot of concerns about that. And so there is an exemption that if you're breeding for the purposes of a class 3 wild cat with a domestic cat with the intent to retail sell these the product, a hybrid, those people are also exempt. They just have to provide documentation to the Oregon Department of Agriculture. The effective date, we also took out the emergency clause, and so those people have basically until January 1, 2008 before the bill goes into effect. It is important to note that Oregon is one of 22 states that we don't currently prohibit private possession of these kind of dangerous, inappropriate wild animals as pets. And so really do urge your aye vote.
Mr. Barrows.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dave Barrows, representing the Oregon Veterinary Medical Association. Our association and our national association are opposed to the keeping and breeding of captive wild and exotic animals, and are in support of this legislation. I've submitted testimony that explains why. I will conclude with that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Questions for anybody else on this panel? Sarah Farrioli.
Thank you. If I understand the bill, if a person who owned exotic animals met an untimely demise, and those animals then became the property of the children of that person, that the children could not therefore obtain the appropriate licenses to continue the care for those exotic animals.
Madam Chair and Senator Farrioli, you mean if the so let me just make sure I'm clear.
They died.
Yeah. from what I understand, it is true.
Okay. So. And I guess, Madam Chair, my contention is if the exotic species were of a wide enough variety of different species, I guess it's my contention that most would end up euthanized.
Well, I think that we're talking about, I think there's about 37 permits in the state that we're including in this. That's how many, I think, are licensed by the Oregon Department of Agriculture. But we are adding crocodiles and alligators to the list, so it would be a little bit more. And but we don't really know, and that's really a good idea especially for our first responders to know how many crocodiles and alligators we are talking about that people have.
Madam Chair, my question had nothing to do with crocodiles and alligators.
Yeah, but those.
It had to do with if you could not place those people, those pets, those exotic animals,
they
would likely be euthanized.
Right. Madam Chair and Senator Farrioli, there are. Within this bill, there are places they can go to wildlife sanctuaries, and we can try to place them in the various places where they're exempt.
In other words, those exotic animals would simply move to somebody else who held a license for exotic animals.
Or a sanctuary.
Or they would be euthanized.
But I do believe there are a lot of exemptions in here where they would make adequate attempts to locate them in appropriate homes.
Madam Chair, or they would be euthanized.
Yeah, or they'd be euthanized.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Farrelly. Other questions? Thank you very much.
Okay. Apparently, Representative Roblin and Representative Boquist are coming. And so until then, let's bring up, holy smokes, Steve Belknap, Cheryl Jones, Molly Schaefer, and then I've got Mike Mills, John Turner, and Roland Sonnenberg.
Cheryl Jones is not going to testify. She's just here.
Okay. Oh. All right. Then Mike Mills, you get to come up.
What an honor, Mr. Mills.
You don't have to. You don't have to if you don't want to. Okay. I think score brownie points with the chair that way. Good afternoon and welcome. Thank you.
Thank you.
Do you want to go first?
No, go ahead.
Okay. Chair Brown, members of the committee, I'm Molly Schaefer. I own and operate a USDA licensed facility in Marion County, have for the last 22 years. We are a licensed breeding facility. We also do quite a bit of rescue, and we supply animals for educational facilities, including Busch Gardens, San Diego Zoo, our own Oregon's West Coast Game Park, and shows like David Letterman, The Ellen Show, Carson Daly. You've probably seen a lot of our animals on television if you stay up late at night.
That would not be me.
Which that would be the good Senator
Farrelly.
Okay. The previous testimony stating that I, as a USDA licensee, would not be affected is actually incorrect. It would affect me in a number of ways. First of all, this bill is being passed in every state in the union, is what their attempt to do is, in which case the animals that I do sell to private individuals, that market would go away. So unfortunately, that part of that market is what helps me do my rescue. So my ability to afford to do rescue, which I already can't afford to do, would completely go away. And currently, California passed a similar ban about 15 years ago. I have probably one-third of the animals in my facility are rescues out of California. What happens when you place a complete prohibition is that it creates an underground black market, basically, for these animals. People will have them anyway. They'll bring them in illegally without health certificates, without import permits. They have to keep them hidden so that they're not turned in. And the way that we get most of these animals is they've had something happen where they need some acute medical care. So the owner thinking, okay, my pet's going to die, so I better take it in anyway. They take it to the vet. The animal's confiscated. I get a phone call saying, okay, do you want to take this animal or do you want us to kill it? My answer has always been in the past, I'm going to take it. I now have thousands and thousands of dollars that I owe my veterinarian. I'm getting to the point where I can't take any more animals. I know our sanctuary here in Oregon, Wildcat Haven, is absolutely filled to capacity also. As is our, we have a primate Oregon primate rescue, and I spoke to Polly Schultz, who's the operator of that rescue. She also is over capacity. So there really are no places for these animals to go other than to the vet to be stuck with a needle and killed. So that's, to say that I'm not impacted, I guess I would disagree with that. I'm impacted in a number of ways. I would guess, being one of the more well-known exotic animal people in the state, I'm going to be the first person that gets a phone call. So I do feel like it would have a huge financial impact on me. The other thing about this bill that I think the people who wrote it didn't understand, the way that our permit system works in Oregon, it's a biannual permit. Before you get your animal, you have to apply to the Department of Agriculture for your permit. This is a facility permit. It's not a per animal permit. So, for instance, a person could have a capuchin monkey, a serval cat, and
let's say a links on one permit. So to say that the person can keep their particular animal until it dies and not replace it, there really is no way to enforce it the way that this is written, because the permit is a facility permit, and it doesn't identify individual animals. So, for instance, if the serval died, you could replace that serval, and nobody would know the difference. So really, it's the way it's written is rather unenforceable. I don't think they understood when they wrote this that we have facility permits, not per animal permits. The amendments that you've been given are amendments that we actually had drawn up about 4 weeks ago. And this process, being a novice, I didn't quite understand how this works. And it's moved a lot faster than I understood that it would. And I didn't understand that they had to go to a B engross, not the A engross. But basically what those amendments are is exempting the Class 3 animals, which are the smaller animals that we consider not inherently dangerous. In fact, there have been no incidences in this country of any Class 3 animals seriously injuring or killing a person ever in the history of the country. So we feel that those animals should not be included with chimpanzees and lions and tigers and bears. Currently, there's only one private person in the state that holds a permit for a Class 1 or 2 animal. That's for a chimpanzee. I think that person probably would not have an issue with this bill, as that monkey will probably outlive the owner. The rest of the permits are for people that have Class 3 animals that are not inherently dangerous animals. So the amendments that hopefully you have copies of, what that does is exempts the Class 3 animals, and that also would then take care of the problem as far as the permits and not being able to use a facility permit. We would have to change the entire permit system to be an animal per animal permit. So I would urge you to look at the amendments. I think they're fair. I think they're reasonable. It would also take care of 99% of the opposition to this bill, because almost everybody in the state that is in opposition to this bill has a Class 3 pet. And if you exempted Class 3s, then we'll all sit down and shut up. Promise.
All right. Thank you very much. Let's see, Mr. Belknap.
Yes. Madam Chair and committee members, thank you for allowing me to speak. I'll make it brief. I'm also urging a no vote on HB 3437 for the following reasons. Number one, we have the existing permit system in place, which requires every animal owner to have a permit, whether that be issued through the state or through the federal. These permits require annual or biannual inspections by veterinarians, also ensures that the caging is safe and adequate, and that the animals are properly cared for. Don Hanson, Oregon State Department of Agriculture veterinarian, has stated that in the last 4 years there have been 4 exotic animal escapes that have been documented through that agency, of which none have caused injury or public damage to property or to persons. He has basically stated that exotics in Oregon are not a problem because of our existing permit system. In the House, the representatives and public were assured in 3 hearings that this bill would not affect the production of hybrids, which is the wild domestic cat cross. However, with the way this bill is written, it would not allow for the replacement of that wild feline to produce that hybrid. We've heard that the bill would not allow replacement of an animal. Well, you can't breed a dead animal and get a kitten. that is not true, and that it would not allow a replacement. Washington State bill, which just passed recently, was very similar. However, there was the Class 3 exemption, as Washington State did not see that the Class 3 animals were, in fact, inherently dangerous. So I guess my question would be why, when HSUS is promoting this very same bill in this state, they're not considered dangerous in Oregon when they are in Washington. We talked about the one permit for other than a Class 3 animal, that is one chimpanzee in the state. And another issue, as a USDA permittee, I am exempt from this regulation. However, at such time that I either choose or allow my USDA permit to expire, literally overnight, the animals that I own become illegal within this state. I have many elderly, retired, or rescued animals myself. They're of no monetary value. What happens to those animals when my USDA permit is no longer valid? So again, I'm asking you to consider a no vote, and I'm welcome to help in any way that I can.
Thanks. Questions for Ms. Schaefer or Mr. Belknap?
Thank you very much. Appreciate you joining us.
Thank you.
Next up, John Turner and Roland Sonnenberg. Anybody else wishing to testify in opposition to the bill?
Chair, please proceed.
Chair Brown, members of the committee, my name is John Turner, representing myself, many other concerned citizens. I urge you to oppose 3437. As has been pointed out before, exotics are already regulated in our state. There's a number of regulations covering a number of classes of animals. Opposition has raised concerns of exotics in the state, including invasive species. There's recently been a bill, Senate Bill 804, which addresses that and gives Fish and Wildlife the ability to address that, so that is now a non-issue. There are those who point to the dangers of that exotics pose from hoof, fang, or spreading diseases. What they fail to point out is that domestics, whether it be cattle or dogs, pose these same risks that we live with every day, and in many ways are much more exposed to than by the few exotics that we have. Even with the animals that are considered to be the most dangerous of exotics, your chances of dying from an auto is much greater than that of even being an owner of one of these exotics. And the chances statistically are nearly nil of the member of the public being injured. As has been pointed out, there are very few incidents in the country and none in the state involving even the more dangerous, considered more dangerous exotics. The exotic owners that I know, they include some of the most dedicated caregivers of the animals that I've seen. Several small cats and the buffalo are around nowadays primarily due to private owners. Some of the first successful captive breeding of small cats was accomplished in the private. There's a great conservation value in private ownership and what the private people have contributed to conservation of these animals. Big organizations have their place as well, but without the overhead of a large organization, some people have made tremendous strides here. Some people will try to tell you that the private owners make no contribution to conservation because their animal's genetic pool may not be in one particular pedigree program or another. Some of them are, and I'd like to contend that the animals out in the wild aren't part of some pedigree program or a genetic matching program, but they certainly contribute to the survival of their species, as do animals in private hands. Another concern raises the abuse that sometimes happens with animals in private ownerships. Abuse does happen sometimes. Abuse also happens to humans. There are laws about abusing animals and about abusing humans. It's not going to change that, but I don't see anybody proposing laws saying that we shouldn't have children because children get abused. And these animals, for many people, are like family members. They are part of our families. So I'd urge you to vote no on 347. It's a step towards extinction. It keeps people from making this contribution that, frankly, other folks, whether they not be interested in, just aren't making. So thank you.
Thank you. And Mr. Sonnenberg?
Thank you, Chair. Non-assistant Brown and members of the committee for your time.
Oh, her presence is felt even though she is not here.
My colleagues have made most of the points that I planned to make, and my written testimony is kind of a laundry list of why I think this law is ill-conceived and ill-advised. So I won't reiterate all of those, and I hope you will take a minute and look at it. I would like to talk just for a minute about what I think is kind of an underlying issue that we're not really talking about. And Ms. Peterson made an excellent point that most of the people you're hearing testifying against this bill are unaffected. They have USDA licenses. They are exempt. Most of the people that you hear testifying for this bill are unaffected. They already don't have animals. They don't want animals. Virtually nobody who is talking to you about this law is impacted by this law. In fact, pretty much nobody in the state will be impacted by this law because we already have laws that make it illegal to do the things that this law claims to try and prevent. So we're all here for some reason other than this law, and we all talk about it late at night and know what it is, and I just wanted to share it with you guys for a minute because however you vote on this law, you are going to make a significant vote on what is effectively a war that is being waged. And this law won't have any impact on our state, but it will be a significant impact on that war. And that war is basically between a group of people who believe that no animals should be kept in captivity, that captivity intrinsically violates their rights. And whether it is a cat, a dog, a monkey, whatever animal it is, it ought to be free, running wherever it wants to run and being hit by cars and starving to death out in the wild. And they have a valid point that animals have been wild and should be wild, and they make some excellent points. The contrary group is a group of people who believes that animals can be kept, not that they always should be, but that if there is appropriate regulation and if the right people are keeping them, they can be kept well, they can be kept safely, they don't get loose, they have excellent lives, and that continuing to do that is not only ethical, it's essential, that the forests of Madagascar will be wiped out in our lifetime and there will be no place for lemurs unless we have them, that there is no place in the wild for dogs, there is no place in the wild for cows or chickens. They are animals that exist in captivity, and that if you give them a good life in captivity, it can be a great life for them and it can be very safe for the public. The history in Oregon bears that out. There simply are not problems with animals getting loose and causing property damage or injury. Even the people who are advocating laws like this and trying to eradicate all animal ownership have a very hard time coming up with examples other than the occasional dead crocodile or monkey that got loose and was captured 20 minutes later. It just isn't happening. And the reason it isn't happening is because the people who are owning these animals take it very seriously and are very responsible and are in compliance with the current laws and are simply not a problem. The only time it is a problem is people who are violating the current laws, which if we enforced would already be eradicated. So passing new laws does nothing to further that cause, and I think ultimately we all have to keep in mind that this is really just a question of an incremental step towards trying to eradicate all animal ownership. And if you believe that some people can own animals well, whether it's a Labrador Retriever or a Golden, any animal, then you don't pass prohibitive laws that will prevent us all from owning animals. You regulate and ensure that people who do own animals do so responsibly. Thank you.
Questions for the panel?
Mr. Chair.
No. Ma'am?
Just a sort of a left field question. Is a cougar a class 1, 2, or 3?
Class 1.
Class 1.
I believe that non-existent Chair Brown.
We just have had a cougar bill, and I was just wondering what class.
I believe that cougars are also regulated by Fish and Wildlife. And
yeah. You can direct your answers to the co-chair or the vice chair in this case.
Yeah, vice chair.
I haven't testified.
Oh, good.
Sorry for the breach of protocol.
And your testimony is welcome.
You answered my question. Yeah.
I believe that they are regulated by Fish and Wildlife, and it's very difficult to possess one as a private individual already.
Yeah, okay. That's clear.
Any further questions for the panel? Thank you for your testimony. You are welcome here. I notice that we have the co-sponsors of the legislation before us in the room, and I'd like to call forward Representative Boquist and Representative Roebling.
You're on the left.
Just from my perspective, this is all wrong because. not from this perspective, but please proceed.
Chair and committee, my name is Arne Roebling for the record, House District 9, and I'm pleased to be here today to talk about the other side of me. We just had a concurrence motion for the cougar bill. You were just brought that up. But this is about whether we should have and continue to have exotic animals that are not appropriate in our state. And I listened to the previous testimony, and I just wanted to make a statement that, you know, I have no intention of believing that this group that they were talking about, this war that's going on. I'm not involved in the war. I'm in trying to do things that make sense for the state of Oregon. And from my perspective, the exotic animals that are in this bill and the process that we went through in the House, in our committee, to get each of the people to the table and listen to it, and I think you heard that this bill is not going to hurt a lot of the people that you've heard here speak today, because we made a purpose of grandfathering in people and making sure that we were doing this in a systematic way. But I'm one of those people who believes that the animals, like cougar, is a game mammal in our state. It's not exotic. It is here, and it belongs here. Other countries and other places need to do the things that they need to do to keep their animals in their places, and it isn't our purpose. We have zoos, we have organizations and people who have licenses who can breed and take care of these animals. They're exempt in this bill. They can take care of the process of making sure that there are future animals in the, if we're not going to take care of them in the wild. But it isn't about individual ownership for these exotic animals. I do not believe that's in the best interest of our state or even those animals. So for me, the way we worked on the bill, the fact that we took into consideration their ideas and sent it back to committee to put the last amendments in that made sure that those people with in the process of making Bengal cats and others were exempt and could continue to have their businesses was a statement that what we're trying to do is make this a workable bill that says to people, don't continue to think you're going to have exotic animals as pets. It's not the appropriate thing to do. So that's kind of where it was at.
Mr. Chair, distinguished members, Brian Boquist, 23rd House District. Let me talk about a couple of details of the bill. I got on board. I was, in fact, on board this with Mark Haas last session, and I'm on board this time to make sure that crocodiles are, in fact, exotic animals, so that crocodiles don't come over and frequent the John Day River and don't frequent Coos Bay anymore, because there has been a problem with crocodiles. Second reason I brought up the whole crocodile issue, as many of you know, that in my other life, I've had experience in foreign continents. And one of the fastest ways to make money in a foreign continent to take over the government is to smuggle. And there's a large smuggling chain of exotic animals that comes to and from the United States, courtesy of our good European allies, who, of course, smuggle them out of places like Liberia and the Sierra Leone Civil War and elsewhere, and give them false end-user certificates so that they can profit from it. Not that they're not good allies in other things, but they aren't very good allies in this. So that's why we came up with the crocodile on the list. Not sure everybody needs a crocodile in their neighborhood. However, having pointed that out, I would indicate in the bill that there are all kinds of grandfather clauses that come in here. Let me talk about what the bill did not do, and I'm sure you've heard testimony here today, and that we fixed on the far side. That's not the comic, that's the other chamber.
I'm glad you made this.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm kind of wondering right now over there myself, but that's a different topic for a beer or something. The issue, presently under existing law, everything but domestic cats are considered exotic. That's the existing law today. For whatever reason, USDA and others decided that they weren't going to regulate some of these other things like feral cats and jungle cats and all the rest of these. And so presently today, they're illegal in the state of Oregon. Now, the amendments that we put in on the far side made an effort to go in, and because no one knew they were illegal, no one intentionally broke any law. And the fact of the matter is breeding some of these smaller species and stuff, you know, makes sense. It's been going on, and we're not creating, you know, a 150-pound domestic cat that looks like a cougar that's regulated by the wildlife side. So we went in and we fixed those things. So now we're kind of at a catch-22. Whether we like crocodiles or not, or whatever we like and we don't like, presently today the law bans cats except domestic cats. So we have to do something on that side, because if we do nothing, then we're almost at square one, and the whole issue that has been raised about the cats and the breeding of small cats is going to still exist, and it may, in fact, put our agencies in a bit of a quandary what to do. So we need to do something one way or the other, because if we do nothing, the whole issue of feral cats and that is going to come right back probably to see us in February.
Questions for the panel? Representative Boquist, Representative Roblin, thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
I have a question that was that came up earlier in the testimony. It appears that if a person who owns exotic species were to meet an untimely demise, that their children would then not be able to continue the care of these animals, since the person holding the permit would no longer be the holder of that permit, and the children would not have held the permit and therefore could not apply for such a permit. What happens in that case?
There's no transferability.
That's true.
I hadn't thought of that. Ooh, that's on the record. Oops.
One of the problems with these exotic animals is the fact that a lot of times there aren't kids to take them, and there are very few places that want them any longer.
Right. And therefore, would they not be euthanized?
They probably would be.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I've stayed as far away from Measure 37 as possible.
Thank you, gentlemen, for your testimony. Further questions? Seeing and hearing none.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We'll go back to the far side.
That's it.
You're always welcome over here, too. Thank you. And Mr. Tucker, you were signed up to testify. Would you like to come forward now?
Sure.
And any other person here present who would like to testify? Now would be the time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Randy Tucker with Metro. This is not my usual venue, dealing with exotic animals. However, in addition
to... Oh, I don't know about that, Mr. Tucker.
Well, I'll just soldier along here, Mr. Chair. While obviously we are best known for our work on land use and transportation, et cetera, we also own and operate the Oregon Zoo, and our zoo director, Tony Vecchio, actually did come and testify twice in the two House committees, but was not able to be here today on relatively short notice and asked me to come and testify on his behalf. I'm a poor substitute, obviously. However, you do have a letter from Mr. Vecchio. That's right.
Thank you.
So let me just make a couple of quick comments and get away. Obviously, exotic animals take the care of trained professionals for the welfare of the animal and for the safety of the public. And the American Zoo Association has rigorous guidelines for what it takes to be a professional zoo. We have a highly educated and trained professional staff. Most of them have degrees in wildlife biology and zoology, et cetera. And we also have an emergency response team that consists of zookeepers, vets, curators, maintenance staff, security personnel. It's a level of protection in the case of a wildlife emergency that doesn't exist in the case of private ownership of exotic animals. You've just touched on one of the points I believe, Mr. Vecchio's letter, Mr. Chair, the question of, if a zoo director or a zookeeper falls over dead, we've got a whole staff and a public institution that is there to step in. We can hire somebody new, et cetera. If a private individual drops dead, as you pointed out, the likeliest fate for the lion or the tiger or the crocodile is that it'll be euthanized. The zoo does get calls all the time from members of the public who can't handle their pets anymore or who have inherited one in a situation like we just described. They're told that they were often told that if the tiger or the snake gets too big, the monkey gets too aggressive, the zoo will take it. But the zoo can't take it. All of the zoo's animals are there as parts of very elaborate and well-thought-out breeding programs, and they cannot just be taking animals from the public. Again, if someone gets tired of their exotic animal pet, the pet is likely to be the loser. So you've got Mr. Vecchio's testimony. He's goes into it maybe slightly more detail. With slightly more eloquence, but just wanted to go on the record on behalf of the zoo in this instance.
Questions? Mr. Tucker, I have a question. Are zoos also licensed by the USDA as keepers of exotic animals?
I don't know the answer, Mr. Chair. It's possible that somebody else does. Yes, I would assume so.
And, we'll just indicate that the audience universally nodded in the affirmative. Are those licenses for the... zoos substantially different, or the requirements substantially different than the license requirements for zoos?
Again, Mr. Chair, it would be a question that Mr. Vecchio could answer off of, I'm sure, in his sleep, but I'm not going to even begin to pretend to
well,
try.
Well, I'm going to make a guess here because I don't know.
Right.
And if I'm wrong, I'm certain that you will provide the right answer for me.
I will go and get it.
Or Mr. Vecchio
will. I will go
get
it.
Thank you.
That's right.
That I'm going to be willing to make the guess that there is no substantial difference between the licenses for individuals and the licenses for institutions like zoos. And in effect, what we have here is that the licenses that are given to individuals really create mini zoos. But thank you for your testimony.
Ma'am? Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Ferrioli, members of the committee. My name is Nikki Terzieff. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Humane Society, and it appears in good company. I would like to speak on behalf of HB 3437, and I think it is about continuity and responsibility. And as amended, this bill will put into place a statewide framework that addresses the keeping of exotic animals as pets. Right now, because currently, cities and counties have all adopted separate local ordinances, and many of which are stronger than state law. There's no consistency. So this bill will then replace that, will replace the confusing patchwork of laws with a consistent guideline with respect to what animals are deemed most dangerous to keep privately as pets. And finally, the responsibility part, I will be very brief. The responsibility part, this bill will help animal control and humane societies greatly because we are often one of the first to respond to situations involving an escape or an injury or animal cruelty issue. This bill will also eventually phase out exotic animals from being kept as pets throughout the state, and that in time will alleviate the financial burden that we incur and human resources that are placed upon us to respond to these kinds of cases. I have submitted written testimony from Sharon Harmon on behalf of the Oregon Humane Society, where I think you'll see this kind of thing does happen. There's an instance in this written testimony she refers to where there's a tiger on an adjacent lot to a preschool who has spent his days stalking up and down the fence. And one look, I'd say, at Wayne Krieger's door, Representative Krieger's door, will let you know that these are, in fact, forces to be reckoned with.
Question?
Thank you.
Question,
Senator Martin? A tiger is a class one or a class two, and not a class three, correct?
Yeah, 11. The consensus from the audience is that that is correct.
Thank you.
I learned lots.
Chair Ferrioli, yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Further questions from the panel? Hearing and seeing none. Thank you for your testimony. I don't believe that there are any other witnesses that have signed up to testify on this bill. And such as the case, the public hearing on the bill is closed. And that concludes our work for today. We're adjourned.